How are you?
Okay. So now it is 1762, and Moshe Sofer is born to a family, to a father who is a Sofer. And the history of Torah changes very dramatically. 1762, Moshe Sofer, known as the Chassam Sofer, because his primary sefer, Mordechai, if you can just, while we're talking about Chassam Sofer, make sure Rav Soloveitchik is straightened out, his picture. Thank you. So the Chassam Sofer is called the Chassam Sofer because his family name was Sofer, because his father was a Sofer, a scribe. And his primary sefer is called Taras Moshe. So Chidushei Taras Moshe leads to the acronym of Chassam Sofer. I'll talk about his children, but all of his children took names relating to Sofer. Michtab Sofer, Kisab Sofer, Chassam Sofer. So that name almost became a franchise. We'll talk about the lasting impact of the Chassam Sofer, his children, and his Talmidim. So he is born in Frankfurt in Germany. And his parents are very pedigreed. His father actually can trace himself back to Rashi, which means if he can get back to Rashi, you can get back to Yochanan HaSandler, because Rashi was able to trace back to Yochanan HaSandler today. In part because we're so far downstream, and in part because of the Holocaust, it's harder for us to trace ourselves all the way back to. But you're talking even in the 1700s, someone was able to trace himself back to the days of the Tanaim. The Rambam was able to trace himself back to Yehuda Nasi. He was able to trace himself back to Hillel. So and Malchus Beis David. So as long as you're able to create those traces, you can go further back. So he studies with two Rabbanim. Very interesting that he doesn't have this. Typically we have, he taught so-and-so, the Ramban taught the Rashbo, taught the Ritva. Here you have Chassam Sofer, learned by two Rabbanim. One was named Reb Nassen Adler. We have too many of his farm. He's known as the Rebbe of Chassam Sofer. The other Rebbe of Chassam Sofer was Reb Pinchas HaLevi Horowitz. So he's the Mechaber of a Sefer called the Hafla, which is probably one of the most important Achronish Svarim on Ksuvos. Anyone who learns Ksuvos learns the Sefer Hafla. And the Chassam Sofer was evidently such a prodigy that Pinchas HaLevi Horowitz asked him to come. He recruited the Chassam Sofer to his yeshiva, not really to yeshiva, to come learn with him. Yeshivas weren't as popular those days, although we'll see the Chassam Sofer changed that as well. Interestingly enough, we'll talk about this a little bit further later on, a little bit more elaborately. He was involved not just in studying Torah, although that was his primary pursuit. He learned math, history, and astronomy. So this is going to be a very important part of the Chassam Sofer's profile and what made him unique as a gadol. So he was born in Frankfurt. He's a Rav in the Czech Republic, as we know, the Czech Republic, and then in a town in Hungary called Matisdorf, or Matisdam today, Matisdorf, the Matisdorf Shul in Beit Vegan. But the major, major switch happens in 1807. So this is now about 45 years. He's 45 years old. He's known as a gadol. People have been asking him for years to be the Rav in their town, and he's been resisting. But in 1807, he accepts to be the Rav in a town called Pressburg. Pressburg is actually the capital then of the Austrian Empire. It's called by different names in German, but as you know, there's a lot of fluidity between Austria, Hungary, and Germany in Central Europe of the early 19th century. His first wife dies in 1812. He then marries the widowed daughter of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger is the Chassam Sofer's father-in-law. So he marries a widowed daughter. He has about 10 children, as well as then his second wife dies later in his life, and he takes another wife. So he becomes the Rav of Pressburg, one of the largest Jewish communities in Central Europe. But he founds a yeshiva in Pressburg, which at one point has over 500 Talmidim in the yeshiva of Pressburg. We'll get to this a little bit later. He dies in 1839. There are very interesting stories about his burial place. There's a mausoleum near the Danube River that he's buried in. It becomes a major event for the Jewish community. And then towards, I think, World War II, the government had to build a bridge, they had to dismantle the Jewish cemetery. So there was a lot of negotiations, according to some legends, between the Jewish community and the government of Austria, according to Hungary, according to others, because now it's in Hungary, according to others, it wasn't negotiations, it was actually bribing them to keep the Chassam Sofer's grave intact. According to some, it was actually the government was afraid of the curse by dismantling the Chassam Sofer's grave. So essentially, the tomb, the mausoleum, was encased in a concrete enclosure under the bridge that they built, and then it was in 1992 when they got their independence from the Soviet Union. It was actually open. You can go to the Chassam Sofer's grave today, And it's actually the bus stop right near the Chassam Sofer's grave. I think it's called Chassam Sofer Stop or something the equivalent. Okay, so this is his history. This is his biography. Probably his most important legacy. There are probably two important legacies, but one of the two most important legacies is between his children and his descendants. And he had numerous descendants, dozens, who became Rabbanim and founded yeshivas both in Central Europe and then relocated across the world. There are two major yeshivas that are relocated to Yerushalayim, to Israel. One is called the Pressburg Yeshiva, which still operates today in Givat Shaul. So if you're in Givat Shaul and you're walking around and you see the Pressburg Yeshiva, that is Chassam Sofer's descendants that still run that yeshiva. There are other yeshivas. There's a Chug Chassam Sofer, a chain of shuls that operated in his spirit, but since have been incorporated to the mainstream. They're no longer the Chassam Sofer shuls, but when people say the Chug Chassam Sofer, there are certain shuls over the last two generations in Israel that followed his spirit. But between his Talmidim and between his actual descendants, literally he staffed the entire Hungarian Jewish scene. So he basically, if you think, so to speak, you've spent a lot of time this year hearing about Rav Lichtenstein and how many Talmidim of his have become Rabbanim and teachers across the globe. So the Chassam Sofer has, obviously it's a different era. You're not going to have as large a worldwide imprint the way that Rav Lichtenstein or modern day people have. But in terms of radically changing Hungarian Jewry and Hungarian yeshivos and Hungarian Rabbanim, he becomes, I can't think of someone, certainly in the 19th century, probably even in the last 300-400 years, who is as responsible for producing as many Rabbanim, again, both his blood descendants as well as his Talmidim. The list is a who's who of Rabbanim in Hungary, and then, of course, Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld came from that yeshiva, modern-day people who operate in Eretz Yisrael. And, of course, don't forget that Rav Amital, who before the war was educated in Hungary and always felt that he would represent the Hungarian Torah style, which is obviously influenced by Hasidus. That's a separate issue which we'll talk about as we start focusing on Hasidus. But there was a very, very distinct non-Hasidic Torah tradition in Hungary. That's all Chassam Sofer. So whatever that stands for, Rav Amital was very, very insistent that represented something he wanted to flavor this yeshiva with. So you'll see there's certain parts of this yeshiva that still carry the flavor of the Chassam Sofer's tradition. What's interesting, and I'll say this here in this context, you probably won't hear too often, is the Chassam Sofer operates before Zionism becomes a controversial issue. So he's a Rav in Pressburg in 1807 until 1839 when he dies for those 33 years. It's not yet a major, major rift. And there's another major rift that he participates in very actively. We'll talk about that, Reform Conservative Haskalah. He's very, very supportive of Eretz Yisrael in general and of moving to Israel in particular, and even at one point about moving even if it isn't necessarily being driven by the classic religious establishment. So let me just read some quotes and reference points. There's been a lot of work, even in the Zionist camp recently, to go back, because obviously over the last 150 years, a large portion of the typical, I don't like to use the word Haredi, because Haredi is a post Holocaust and post 48 term. So Yochanan Wasserman wasn't Haredi, he was a Rosh Yeshiva. Chavetz wasn't Haredi, but most of those people who are Torah leadership were not enthralled with the Zionist enterprise, in part because it was being driven by non-religious and non-Orthodox people, secular people. But certainly when you go back to 1800, you're not talking about a Haredi or not a Haredi, although the Haredim certainly identify very deeply with them. You'd ask anyone, oh, it's a Hechsher of the Chassam Sofer. That's the equivalent of saying it's a Haredi Hechsher. But certainly this is one individual who is very overt and very vocal about Eretz Yisrael. So, for example, in Maseches Sukkah, he talks about an Esrog. He compares living in Eretz Yisrael to the mitzvah of tefillin. It's the equivalent of putting on tefillin, living in Eretz Yisrael. You can find that in Maseches Sukkah on Daf Lamed Aleph, in one of his drashos. Keep in mind, I mentioned his prodigiously creating Talmidim. He left over 100 kisveyat. So he basically wrote 100 svarim. None of them were published in his lifetime. So a lot of the work of his descendants, all these rabbanim and these yeshivas by extension, has been trying to take some of these kitveyad and publish it. And the most important svarim, the ones that are known the most, are his Chidushei Torah, Chassam Sofer al Torah, Chidushei Torah as Moshe al Torah, his tshuvos, which are basic tshuvos. He was the halachic authority in Europe of the 19th century, so by extension those tshuvos filter down. His drashos, his Agadah on Pesach, those are the primary works. He also wrote a book on history, talk about later, not just Jewish history, but the history of Central Europe through all the wars and invasions of the early 19th century. So he did value history very, very deeply, and he writes about it in some of his drushas. When Eretz Yisrael, he says, is referred to Eretz HaChaim, the land of the Chaim. So we talk about an extra spirit, an extra ruchnius. He says that, no, if you're living in Galus, you're considered dead. If you're living in Eretz Yisrael, you're considered alive, because Galus is a strategic existential threat to Jewish identity and to Jewish history. So if you're living in Galus, you may be personally alive, but as a people, you're under threat, you're under siege, and therefore you're considered dead, whereas in Eretz Yisrael, it's Eretz HaChaim. Jewish history springs to life and resuscitates itself. There's a mission that says, Yafa sha'achas sol tshuva maisim tovim b'olam hazeh mikol chay olam haba. It's a very, very provocative statement. That part of our life cannot just be equivalent to olam haba, the life of eternity, the life of perfection, but can supersede it. He says that only applies to being in Eretz Yisrael. If you're outside of Eretz Yisrael, that statement that you can create life on this terrestrial life, life on this planet that could supersede Olam Haba, that's only available in Eretz Yisrael. So when you think about what you want to accomplish over the next 6 months before you leave, if that's when you leave, think about trying to find those moments that are equivalent to Olam Haba. He felt that even though we live in Galus, we're still being nurtured and nourished from Eretz Yisrael. And this led to his participation in two very, very interesting, I'll actually say one very interesting halachic question. Number one, he still felt, and it's a very audacious claim, that we're still chayv in aliyah l'regel today. So if you're living in Melbourne, or you're living in Sydney, you have to get on a plane 3 times a year and come to Eretz Yisrael. A lot of frequent flyer miles. But that's a very, very minority opinion. But a more interesting opinion is he becomes one of the first sources to be used in the great debate of the middle 19th century about whether we should bring a Korban Pesach in today's day and age. Korban Pesach is in that sweet spot. This has nothing to do with the Chasam Sofer. There are two problems with bringing Korbanos. Number one, if it's a Korban Sibur, you can't bring the Korbanos because Korban Sibur have to be dedicated by Machzis HaShekel. There's no such thing as a Korban Sibur. So we can't bring Korbanos in Yom Kippur. We can't bring Korbanos on Shabbos and Yom Tov because we don't have a coalescent Machzis HaShekel. On the other hand, a Korban Yachid, which doesn't require Machzis HaShekel, private funds, you can't bring because you're Tamei. If it's a Korban Sibur, we can look away from Tumah. Tumah HaTribut Sibur. The entire Sibur is Tamei. You can still process a Korban Sibur. You can't buy a Korban Yachid. So that overlap creates no option for a Korban today. If it's a Korban Sibur, we don't have to worry about Tumah. Remember, Tumah, you don't just have to worry about Tumah Skeri. If you want to go to the Har Bayis, you just have to take away your Tumah Skeri. If we bring a korban, you're all tamei meis. You all touch someone who touched a dead body. We don't have paraduma. So tumah is a blocker for any korban. You can't bring a korban. You can't even dispatch a korban if you're tamei. So korban sibur is out because there's no machzis HaShekel. Korban yachid is out because everyone's tamei. Korban pesach is right in that sweet spot. It's a korban that we can ignore tumah, but it's a korban yachid. So that's why the only debate is not about a chatas or an asham or not about korbanos yom kippur. The only debate is about korban pesach. And there was a very, very lively debate in the 19th and early 20th century about sacrificing a Korban Pesach. And even those who denied it, it typically was disqualified on very, very technical issues. Well, we don't have Big Day Kahuna, we don't have Kohanim, we don't have Tchelos, but it seems like many of the major issues were solved and it failed on secondary issues. So his statements about Korban Pesach and about the importance and the ability to be makriv Korban Pesach today become fundamental baselines of this whole conversation. In one of his drashas, he says as follows, listen carefully, because many of his descendants that moved to Eretz Yisrael were ardent anti-Zionists. So already his descendants and his talmidim become very active in the political and ideological debates about Zionism. But he's writing this before those debates take root. Al tiyu misonei Tzion. Don't be like the haters of Tzion. She'enam rotzim lashuv, that don't want to go back to Israel. U'bocharim leishev tachas hamalchius, and they decide to live in Galus under false and foreign sovereignty. Now, interestingly enough, he didn't just talk the talk. He didn't make Aliyah, or didn't try to make Aliyah, as opposed to some of the others we've talked about, the Vilna Gaon and the Beis Yosef. But many of his Talmidim made Aliyah, and they formed small little Chasam Sofer-flavored sects and yeshivas, as I said before, in Yerushalayim. So that's something that isn't often talked about because he's associated with the Haredi establishment, which is anti-Zionist, but it's something which is very, very apparent in his works, and people have done a lot of works surrounding it. What the Chassam Sofer is mostly known for, and is most influential beyond just the producing such great Talmidim and such great Svarim and being a halacha, what he's mostly known for is the following phrase and what it reflects. He coined the phrase, he didn't coin the phrase. The Gemara has a discussion as to whether chadash, new grains, before Pesach, before Korban Omer, is it asu min hatara, is it asu midrabanan, where is it asu min hatara? So the Gemara has a statement called chadash aser min hatara. Chadash, new grains, is aser min hatara. The Chassam Sofer coined this phrase to be used in the great debate of the early 19th century, Reform, ultimately conservative, Maskilim. This is the first secularizing wave of modern orthodoxy, modern orthodoxy in terms of a camp, but of orthodoxy in the modern era. And Pressburg, where he is, the Rav, is right in the crosshairs. There's a lot of intellectual ferment and a lot of questioning. And to a degree, the Jewish community works with the Austria-Hungarian dynasties much more in sync. It's not as hostile as in Russia. So that could become both a lever for some of the reformers to use government influence, as well as for some of the traditionalists to try to solicit government support. So the relationships in Central Europe are much more amicable, less hostile than, let's say, in Russia or certainly in Arabic land. So you can, part of this whole debate is on whose side will the government fall, on the traditionalists or on the reformers. And the Chassam Sofer coins this phrase, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Anything new and any attempt to change minhag is asur in the Torah. And of course, in today's discourse, that's quoted all the time against modifications, against adjustments. Obviously, it has one historical context in the early part of the 19th century, a completely different historical context today. At one point, for example, the Chassam Sofer says that if there's a minhag in the city, it has the halachic status of a neder, which obviously is based on Gemara. It doesn't say this and throw it off the cuff. What amuses me is when people participate in these debates without any halachic knowledge. At the very least, learn the halachos. You're here in yeshiva. You want to be involved in shaping the future of our communities. So sit there and learn for several years seriously, rather than just, you know, this person backs up his position with 30 different rishonim. You come and say, I think we should do this or do that because I think it's important. It's intellectually humiliating when I hear people speak without any halachic knowledge. At the very least, you know, and from your standpoint, if you want to be people that shape our communities in the future, so be a halachic heavyweight. Sit and learn halacha seriously. Sit and learn Gemara seriously. Rather than just being an ideologue who believes in certain agendas without knowing where it stems from or comes from. Yona, I'm sorry.
Yes. When you say he was so much against the scholar, he was himself, you said.
Right. But certainly against, right. So let's start with, he was against two things. Number one, the reformism movement. And everyone listen to what I'm about to say. He was one of the first, if not the first, to sense that this was not just a flash in the pan. This was not just, okay, some reformers in the local shul want to make changes. Let's find a way to deal with it. He sensed this as a movement that would radically challenge orthodoxy. So you could call the Chassam Sofer, this would be a good way to think of him, the first orthodox rabbi. That would be a very interesting phraseology. Because before him, everyone is orthodox. So being an orthodox rabbi is a redundant statement. He's the first orthodox rabbi. And he holds the fort, so to speak, in Hungary, in Austria, at the same time that Rav Shamshon and Paul Hirsch is defending the fort in Germany and in Western Europe with a very, very different strategy. And I'm sure we'll talk about Rav Shamshon and Paul Hirsch, a very, very different strategy. And they corresponded with each other. There was interaction between the two. Or they commented, so to speak, on each other's strategies. His was very hard line. So when they attempted, when they have the dates here in 1811 to introduce secular studies into the school and press, he studied secular studies, but he didn't want it to be institutionalized in the yeshiva or in the school. It was very sensitive, he said, to history, to math, to astronomy, to other areas, but it shouldn't be institutionalized. It's part of the curriculum of the yeshiva. In 1819, there was a shul that wanted to make all sorts of changes, introducing music into the services, into the davening. Taking out parts of tefillah that mentioned gula. This is the high tide of Orthodox conservative debate. Should we always pine for Gula? Or now that emancipation has come, we don't have to think about redeeming ourselves by relocating to Israel under a Messianic kingdom. We could just redeem ourselves in Germany or in Hungary or in Austria just by responding to the invitation of emancipation. So let me read you what the Chassam Sofer writes about emancipation. Now he's not talking about reform, he's talking about the whole, most Jews were thrilled, most Jews were exhilarated. We now have invitations to be part of society. Listen to these words, because I think we're so far downstream that many people feel like, oh, opportunity to be part of the Gentile world, to be part of colleges, to be part of universities, to be part of professions, it's wonderful. Think of our backwards ancestors who were stuck in discriminatory Europe. He writes, Hatzarahi behefach. It's the opposite. Everyone thinks that the old ages of Jews being suppressed, that was Tsaras, and now we have redemption. The opposite. Hamalchus no tenes cheres leYisrael. These governments are giving freedom and emancipation. Umagbi asam, and it's elevating them. Umekar vasam, and it's drawing them closer to us, to them. V'hi tzara gedala mirishana. This is more concerning than the original situation where the Jews were distanced. Shebavaseinu harabim. Our failure is kol megamas Yisrael. Our entire interest liskari v'alsari melucha. We just want to be like them. And mimic their behavior. V'lazov tara mitzvahs mirtzonim. And that will cause Jews to opt out of religion. Zenik or shibud. That's shibud. V'lo avdas. We were avadim until 1800, emancipation, 18th century, 19th century. Now we're not avadim, we're mishubadim. Ki b'nei charam e'avdas heim. We're no longer of other, and we're no longer economically, politically discriminated and persecuted, but now we're being drawn into a world that will play with our minds and mess with our value systems. That becomes his fame. That, if you mention the Chassam Sofer, that's how most people will associate. The hard-line response, preventing Reform Judaism from infiltrating the Austro-Hungarian Empire. As I mentioned before, he was very sensitive and very supportive of secular studies. In fact, in one of his drashos, he writes that the interpretation of the bracha asher nasan lanu taras emes v'chaye olam nata b'sochenu. Why the double language? Nasan lanu taras emes. What could come after taras emes? Chaye olam. So traditionally, that bracha, like the Beis Yosef, interprets that to mean taras emes is taras shebichsav, Hashem's Torah. Chaye Olam is Tara Shebal Peh. It's a different phenomenon. I'm not going to get into that. Beis Yosef, very famous Beis Yosef. For the Chassam Sofer, in one of his drushos, Asher Nasan Lano Taras Emes is Tara. V'chaye Olam is non-Tara learning. Math, history. I wouldn't imagine he was supportive of literature or philosophy, but certainly math and history and astronomy, the hard sciences, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's direct product, not necessarily the product of human beings inspired by morality and divine abilities. So that's a bracha. Hashem gives us Torah and he plants and he delivers opportunities to study. So I think there was a difference between supporting them, and this is what I've told you all along. If you go back 300 years, I've said this several times this year, if you haven't heard this from me, it's important to hear it again. We live in a hyper-ideological age. Dati Lumi, Torah Mada, Modern Orthodox, Haredi, this. It's very attractive, very exciting. I can promise you in 200 years, all these phrases will fade. And no one will care. No one will even know. You'll have to Google, what does it mean, Modern Orthodoxy? 300 years ago, everyone exhibited these tendencies. Some people read more secular knowledge, some didn't. Some people supported the state of, some people didn't. But they weren't camps and groups and definitions and ideologies. We live in a hyper-ideological world because three things have happened over the last 150 years. The whole secularization I mentioned before, the Holocaust, and the State of Israel. These are three major events that people had to constitute groups and movements. How do we respond to these three events? Is the Holocaust part of the normal, not the normal, but the continual repression of the Jewish people? Is it a unique event in history that signals a change in history? Is the State of Israel a redemptive event, a divine intervention, or a historical miscarriage? How should we respond to reformations and changes? So we've grouped ourselves into ideological camps, and you do live in certain, but God forbid you should define yourself as a modern Orthodox Jew or a Dati Lomi Jew. You can't live in your own community. You have to live with people of similar values to build schools and shuls and express similar values, but don't limit yourselves by, that's who I am. It's a joke. It's a historical myopia. 300 years ago, everyone lived together. You had limited resources. And, okay, this one had this inclination and tendency. That one had that inclination. And if you still go to small towns in Europe or small towns in the United States, people don't have the luxury of creating divisions. Everyone shares the same mikvah, the same shchita, the same shul, the same. So it's important to respond to these issues, but don't imprison yourself by defining yourself based on ideological wins that are important now, but they were never important and they will never be important. They're just historically contextualized issues that are not eternal and certainly are not meaning. They're skins. They're not meaning. They're not the substance of Frumkeit and religious experience. So the Chassam Sofer is a perfect example. He has a very, very supportive statements about secular studies. I don't think anyone would call him a Torah Modernik, because Torah Modernik today represents an attempt to institutionalize and articulate a synthesis. But you could be someone that lives Torah Modernik without believing in Torah Modernik as a movement, because you read and you find yourself very... I had a Rebbe in YU told me, no one would mistake him for a Torah Modernik adherent, the way he dresses and the way he spoke. He said he completed 3 PhDs. He did the coursework and the legwork, the 3 PhDs, but he never completed the actual thesis because, on principle, he didn't want to cross that line and be called a doctor or participate in that institutionalized form of secular studies, which I think is a very... I respect that. I may not agree with it, but I respect that. So don't all of a sudden peg people by what community they're affiliated with or what names or ideologies they subscribe to. And the Chassam Sofer really is that type of person. He's very supportive of moving to Israel in a pre-Zionist world in which these ideological boundaries. You know, you're right, he supported secular studies, but not institutionalized secular studies. He took a hard line to reforms. Who knows what he would say today in the state of Israel, where making reformations and adjustments to create a greater inclusion is a whole different dynamic than it was in Pressburg in the early part of the 19th century. In the 19th century, there was a community, and you could create a hard line, black and white, absolute, you're in or you're out. Today, the reality of life in Israel is we have to live with Jews who don't even know what Reform and Conservative is, but they're not religious in the classic Orthodox sense. How do we include those people in our army, in our society? It's a whole different ballgame, and don't think simplistically. And I assume, since we have to end now, there's one thing the legacy of the Chassam Sofer can teach us, is not to tag people simplistically based on how they've been appropriated by certain camps. Oh, he's the Haredi granddad. No, he was a major force. And since I'm not speaking in Lakewood or Punavich, I'm speaking to you, don't for a second, because people who talk in the Chassam Sofer affiliate themselves with communities that you're not part of necessarily, don't for a second ignore his influence and read his svarim and read his ideas, A, because he shouldn't be communally in prison, and B, because he wasn't part of that community. He was pre-ideology, pre the camps that we have now. And of course, don't ignore how he... I can't imagine too many people in the 19th century that shaped Torah as dramatically as he did. You'd have to leap forward to the late part of the 19th century. Certainly people like Reb Chaim shaped Torah in yeshivas, people that built yeshivas, but he didn't just shape Torah by teaching 400 boys in yeshiva. His Talmidim went out and basically entrenched Torah Judaism in Austria and Hungary throughout the 150 years leading up to the Holocaust, when, of course, it was dramatically destroyed.
Yeah, I was wondering why you made a broader secular studies than when we're being part of the Torah.
Yeah, yes, that's a very strange interpretation. Again, he emphasized that Torah comes before secular studies, so they're not equal. And once you absorb Torah's MS, then secondarily, but Austin, if I take your question one step further, would you make a Birchas HaTorah if you just study math or science? Obviously not, but inserting secular studies into a bracha that we typically associate with Talmud Torah is a very, very bold assertion of, as Yona said, support for studying these, but not necessarily institutionalizing the value form. Okay?